are you and what are you doing here?
Hi, everybody.
Well, what are we waiting for?
This is fantastic.
Hello, hello, hello.
This will only hurt for 22 minutes.
It's very early. I may have to hurt you. Call me in 5 minutes.
This is something that is treatable. This is something that is fixable.
Hey, this is not a test.
Oh, my God, it's early.
The Goblins and the Ghouls replaced our usual intro music. Welcome for the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show, weaving together a mosaic of voices from the arts, pop culture, personal growth, and justice. Getting all kind of spooky in here as we get ready for Halloween. Yeah, we'll do a little preview of our annual Halloween Spooktacular this Friday. Take another romp through the infamous pop culture sideshow. Looks like Boehner is cleaning out the barn. We may have a budget deal, and the government may not shut down. Exciting news, right? Inspiration to action. Challenge success stories as well will get you in the mix. Are you listening live? It is Tuesday, October 27th, 9 a.m. out west, 11 central, noon here in the east. Number in motion 347-857-4505. And, yeah, of course, whether you're listening live or on podcast, you can chime in via our bustling 24/7 Twitter feed at AB Wright. The show today brought to you in part by Progressive Insurance. Bundling can save you a bundle. Find out how at progressive.com. And by Ford, power by design. You know, one of the favorite things I like to do on the show is to welcome fellow authors into the fold. It's always fun to have a mystery author with us who's also a Mets fan. I think I have one of those guys on deck. Welcome to Tim Hall. He's the author of the Bert Shambles mystery series, Dead Stock, and the latest, Tie Dye. So let's go Mets, Tim, and welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Amy. It's really great to be here.
A lot of fun to have you here. It's exciting, I know, for Mets fans. We're not gloating, though. We don't try to gloat because we have people all over the country who root for other teams. But just a little.
You know? Oh, so I'm married to a Chicago girl, so, you know, the Cubs.
Oh, my God. That must have been a tough week last week, huh?
It was. We like to say that we couldn't lose. You know, that's the way we looked at it. So
there you go. Okay. It happened. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the Bert Shambles mysteries and what came first, you know, the chicken or the egg? Did Bert come first or did the story come first?
Oh, I think Bert really came first. You know, I actually wrote a first fragment of this character a long time ago, and I can kind of remember very well how it happened because it actually became the first line in the first book. And I just remembered this voice, this sort of, I guess in a way, a younger version of me saying something in my head. And it just kind of stopped me in my tracks. And I can't explain it, but I just knew that I had sort of discovered this character who I was eventually going to write about.
So you were walking around with him in your head for a while. I think that happens
yes.
to me a lot, too.
Yes.
Yeah, very, yeah. And so how did so then all of a sudden you have it in your head for a while and then suddenly you felt compelled, I want to write this book? I mean, give us a little, you know, insights into your process.
Well, I had been writing crime and mystery stories on and off for about almost 20 years. I was also doing a lot of other stuff. I did some journalism and reporting and travel pieces, technology. I was doing some stringer journalism for some local newspapers while, you know, I've always had a day job as a graphic artist, so it was sort of a secondary source of income, and I was getting personal essays published, and I wrote a couple of novels that were more, a little more literary, a little bit more maybe Romana Clef, about 20-something romantic and professional struggles and so on. But this character and some other stories I had, they just kept popping up. It was the one genre I just kept going back to. And I don't know, about 4 or 5 years ago, I just finished another project, and I was looking around, and my mom's house, my mom said, Tim, you know, you have a box of old writing that's here. I don't want you to, you know, lose it or to get thrown out in case it's important. I went over there and I picked it up one day, and lo and behold, I found this envelope with about 20 pages of this story I'd completely forgotten about, and it was this Bert Shambles character, and I instantly I said, oh my gosh, this is what I've got to write next. So
yeah.
That got me started on it.
There you go. It was kismet. You were meant to find it at that time, and then it got you rolling. You mentioned that you always came back to mysteries. Tell me, were you attracted as a kid to reading mystery stories, and who were some of your favorite authors?
Absolutely. It was the first genre that really captured my imagination. When I was about 9 or 10, my grandma gave me a complete collection, one of these little hardback, those like small hardback shelf editions, like, you know, well-read libraries would buy those very nicely bound, partial leather sort of bound volumes, a little miniature volume set of Edgar Allan Poe. And I remember I was only about 10 years old. I could not get through. You know, his prose was pretty chewy then. It's still a little bit chewy for me now.
Yeah.
But
right.
I tried reading, you know, The Gold Bug. I tried reading the horror I liked. You know, I love The Telltale Heart, some of those. But I also was fascinated by the early detection stories. And I definitely think that was my first aha moment, because I thought that was fascinating, even though he was way too difficult for me at that point. And then in school, I was read a ton of Agatha Christie. And I was also into my J.R. Tolkien, The Hobbit, Lord of the Rings. But I got out of other genre pretty early. I mean, I read a lot of sci-fi in my teens and early 20s. But from about 22 or 23 on, I pretty much was exclusively reading crime and mystery. You know, and I've just read through the genre as much as possible from the early classics on up to the current day.
Yeah. So it's stuck. It stuck with you.
Yeah.
You know, lured you in, and you kind of, it clung to your psyche. That was the kind of thing that you were drawn to. And what do you think about, what is it that fascinates you so much about this kind of writing? Is it the puzzle of the story, or the characters, or all of the above? I mean,
I think the most important aspect of it for me, at least this, and the stuff that I like to read and write, is that the good guys can win. You know, I think it just triggered a sense of justice in me, and a sense of that, you know, yeah, sometimes your hero could be down and out, and good people get killed, and bad things happen to good people and whatnot. But it just gave me some faith in a world that there could be some sense of justice, or of good prevailing over evil. And I think I felt it just more there than I did. It just spoke to me more through that genre than in other genres. You can find that in, I mean, of course, fantasies, epic, sci-fi. I mean, you find that good versus evil, obviously, in every genre, but in crime and mystery, I think it just came through the loudest and clearest to me. So I think that was my primary motivation.
Well, certainly in our cozy mystery genre, for example, it usually winds up that way. I think most exclusively winds up that way. I was just thinking, wouldn't it be interesting if it doesn't? Because in other crime and thrillers, sometimes the bad guy does emerge the victor, especially if they want to have sequels, and, you know, the boogeyman is kept over, held over for another appearance or two or six, you know. So that's kind of interesting. But it is also interesting to me how popular this genre is, how glutted the field is, and how it is a timeless genre. A lot of people are drawn to it because, especially the cozy, I guess, it seems like everything's fine. You know, you're attracted to the small towns or the provincial lifestyles that these books offer, and the quirky characters. Everything seems fine, but of course we know murders are just around the corner. And that, I think, there's a hint of danger, but there's also something quaint about them. You know, it's an interesting juxtaposition. There you go.
Right. Yeah, and I think
it's funny. I just found out today. This is go ahead, sir.
No, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to throw this out. Somebody just threw this statistic out that last year, 27 Americans admitted they didn't even read a single book. But I would say, yeah, but 99% of them wrote a book. I mean, this is how glutted this world has become with people writing books, and I often say, who have no business writing books. So it's sort of hard sometimes to get your book and your work out. It's not so hard to get it out there, because anybody can publish anything they want with self-publishing, et cetera, but to get it to stand out and to attract a readership. Do you agree with that, and what have you found in terms of marketing and promotion?
Well, I don't know. I like to think that, you know, I like to believe in abundance. You know, it's maybe part of that same crazy thought that makes me believe in that good can triumph over evil. I don't know. But, you know, and here I am a Mets fan. I've got to believe stuff like that, right?
Yes, we've got to believe.
but I think, you know, use whatever analogy. I think, you know, it goes back to what Emerson said, you know, that a person's worldview is a confession of their character. I just believe in a world of abundance. The more, the better. You know, we have twice as many. Certainly in this country alone, the population's doubled since 1970. Maybe that's worldwide, too. I'm not sure the exact numbers. You know, there's more of us. There's more literacy because of the internet. You know, I remember 20 years ago, people said this is going to destroy literacy and kids will never read. They're all going to be on screens. And then, hello, Harry Potter, you know, and suddenly kids could devour 4,000 pages of fiction within a week. You know,
amazing,
you know,
right? Yeah.
It made you know, J.R.R. Tolkien, that I loved as a kid, look like E.E. Cummings. You know what I mean? Like, so many people are reading these epics that are thousands of pages long and getting into other things and series and investing in characters and worlds. And, I mean, how has this not been a glorious age for literature the past, you know, 20 or so internet years? Maybe not for certain businesses within it. You know, it's not a great time to be a newspaper or certain lifestyle magazines that are struggling because of the logistics of print and distribution. But, you know, I just think it's been a fantastic, magical time to be a writer, and I continue to believe that.
Well, we do. As I always say, we live in the creative age where anybody can get their stuff into the world, and that is a great motivation to begin with because I do creativity coaching and teach writing classes, and I'm old enough to remember when it was harder to get your stuff into the world. So we really have no – and that would be an obstacle that a lot of people would stop at. Oh, my God, nobody's going to publish this. Well, you can now. It's always good to have a publisher, but you can publish it yourself if you want to. You can put up a blog, and who knows? I mean, you might get one reader. You're right. Or you might get – it might go viral. You don't know. So I think you're right about that it is the chance for people to put their work into the world. Filmmakers, musicians, writers, all kinds of artists can really get out there, but it does – it still gluts up things. So it's still, as easy it is to get it out there, you still want to get attention. You want people to find you. So you have to learn the tricks of the trade, and I think that's, you know, trial by error what works in terms of promoting and marketing. But I do agree with you. We do live in a creative age, and there's nothing wrong with that and nothing wrong with celebrating creativity. And I firmly believe, as you hinted at, that everybody has that creative gift inside them. It's just that some people don't access it, you know, don't choose to access it, or are thwarted by maybe what happened to them in school or family pressures, et cetera. And I think, you know, if you want to go for it, this is a great time to do it. I agree. But you still have to accept the fact there's a glut. That's all I'm saying.
There is a glut, and no doubt. And if you notice people who really make it, and a lot of marquee names or you know, A-list type people who make it big, you will, I believe, in virtually 100% of the cases – see people, at least those are certainly who achieve fame during their lifetime and have successful careers, those are people who went after that and wanted that very badly. You know, there are nobody, even a Stephen King, you know, with two, you know, right out of college with one or two young kids and working at a laundromat or whatever and on food stamps, you know, and really struggling. He was out there. He was submitting his work day and night. He was trying to connect and find an audience, and he was struggling to do that. You know, in my
He threw Carrie away. His wife was the one that took it out of the garbage. You know that story, right?
Right, exactly. Oh, absolutely. And said, I think you should finish this. But he wasn't a quitter. I mean, he hit a low point, you know, like you're going to. If you're sitting up there in poverty up in Maine, young, with ambition and dreams and trying to support a young family, and, you know, you might throw your Carrie out with the bathwater. So that's one of the great stories, you know. But again, every one of these people out there did it. You know, 10 of the roughly 50% of the Amazon top 20 books of at least 2012 and I think 2013, they were all self-published, the bestsellers. About 50% of the bestseller list has been self-published in recent years. And that shows you that not only are some of those authors able to go out there and do it and get audiences, more power to them, but they also have to write something that connects with people. Whether it's Fifty Shades of Grey or a Twilight or what have
okay,
you.
Yeah, right. All right. Let's not go there.
What?
Okay. My critical, you know, view about some of these things that become popular, just because it's popular doesn't mean it's good either, is another question. But
yeah, but that's always good. You know what I mean? That's
of course.
That's always
of course. No, of course. Of course. That's right. The bestseller list is generally populated with things that are popular that are not necessarily high literature, because a lot of great authors never make it to the bestseller list. So, at least in their lifetime.
What's the other saying I love? Nobody ever went broke underestimating the taste of the American public.
Yes,
let's put it that way. So, but more power to them. Anyone who does it, see, I can't be critical or judgmental about that, because, you know, anybody who's done that or hit that, they still had to sit down and believe in themselves. You know, J.K. Rowling had to believe in herself when she's sitting in that cafe in Scotland trying to keep from going crazy and, you know, nursing a tea for 2 hours because she was broke. You know, she didn't know she was writing Harry Potter. She was just writing a story to keep herself from going crazy, you know. And so whatever the impulse is, I try to go with it and assume the best. But as for the marketing, though, it is tough. And, you know, they used to say most people don't want to write, they want to have written. I mean, I think most people, now that they can have written, that's going to scratch the itch for a lot of people. A lot of people aren't going to go out there and flog the blogs and the internet, whatever they have to day in and day out to make themselves a success. For some people, that's enough. And, you know, that's something I struggle with, because I have a full-time job and I want to succeed. I've been worked very hard at this for many years, and I don't want it to be for nothing. But when, how, what proportion, you know, it's a constant struggle.
Well, it's not for nothing, though, as you just said, you know, because just the doing of it, I think, is important. And that's what I try to impart to everybody that I work with. You know, if you're doing it, that's the great thing. You have to fall in love with the process, because there are no guarantees of how the success will turn out, both in terms of quality and in terms of whether it'll be financially rewarding, whether you're going to get fame out of it, reputation, whatever it is you're looking for. But the process of falling in love with the process and doing it and working at it and trying to get better at it, I think, is really important as well. Also, part of the downside of people self-publishing, for example, is just this impetus to get the work into the world that some people have, and they don't take time to hone it and go over it and make sure that it is ready for the world. And that's where good editing comes in, and that's where publishers help, if you have one. And editors help if you don't have one. You know, I just think everybody needs an editor, even if you're self-publishing. But that's something I think people sometimes don't think about. They just want to get it out there. And it could be, a lot of sloppy work gets put out there. So I'm all for people doing whatever they want to do. And I'm very encouraging for the process. And I think it's cathartic on a lot of levels for a lot of people. And some things are not even meant to be published, but it just works for you in terms of journaling and that kind of thing. Not everything that has to be published. But if you want to publish it, it really should reach a certain standard. That's kind of something I would urge people to keep in mind. Plus, if you haven't written anything yet and you haven't put it into the world, nobody's clamoring to get it. You know, what's the rush? What's the, you know? So make it as good as you can, because then they'll want to come back for the next one. I mean, I think that's it's important for me for the work that I put out there to be ready. And, you know, of course, you can make some changes, I guess, when you put things, well, at least in Kindle. I don't know about it. It's harder for a published book, you know, actual hard print book. To make changes, but you can make modifications and changes, and people do that and update it, and that's okay too. But I think you should try to do the best effort you can out of the gate and see what happens, you know, and that kind of thing.
That's definitely
an issue. And also with websites, I've worked for websites and a lot of things, and even, you know, the standard bearer newspapers like the New York Times and the Washington Post have had egg on their faces, because the idea is to get it up as fast as you can. It doesn't matter if it's accurate. It doesn't really matter if it's well written. Just get it up there. So a lot of websites, if you look, the content might not be factually true, and it also might be very sloppy. There's a lot of grammatical and spelling errors and all of that kind of thing, because they really want people to just get it up there. So if you just want to slap something up there, there are openings for you. If you care about the language and you care about quality, people aren't that interested so much in the internet world, which I think is unfortunate, and that is detrimental, and I think that should change. But of course, speed is the key. They all want to get it up there, so the engine is always moving. It's a 24/7 proposition now, so it's an interesting conversation. But I want to go back to you know, your books, and let's talk a little bit about, you know, Bert Shambles and what he's up against, and how he gets embroiled in these mysteries. He's not a professional detective, right? He just sort of stumbles into it.
No, not at all. He's not a professional anything. He's about 23. He's 23 years old. He's living back in his hometown for the time being. He got into a little bit of trouble when he was out on his own for a couple of years. And he's living back at home and working a flunky job at a thrift shop and really just trying to stay out of trouble. You know, he's just trying to figure out the next move in his life. He definitely feels like, you know, his life's over at 23. Like, he's just part of this sort of new, what they now call new adult genre, where it's, you know, people just starting out in life, you know, just coming up maybe on the quarter life crisis and, you know, just realizing, like, wow, being an adult can be hard and it's not all that fun. And, you know, now I've got bills to pay and all that stuff. So he's up against that stuff. And then in this background of his old hometown, fictional town in Long Island I created, you know, bodies begin to crop up. He often looks like the prime suspect in these, and he's got a generally, he's very often, he's proactive, but a lot of times the catalyst is something that he has to kind of spurs him into action. But, you know, yeah, so that's my main character. And, of course, he's hobbled by another thing, another problem, which is that he's really not very bright. He's not stupid, but he's not dumb, but he's kind of a little bit ditzy is the way my agent described him. He's a little bit maybe on another wavelength at times. So he's also not the, what do they call it, the... like the noble fool. He's not a fool, but he's definitely, he needs help. Let's put it that way. I've made him a guy who needs a lot of help to get through a day.
So does he have a cast of characters around him that are the supporting players that kind of help him, friends or?
He does. He's got a neighbor. He's living in this little kind of rooming house thing, like a little flunky type rooming house. And the only other person who's currently renting a room in this ramshackle old fire trap is, a professional psychic who goes by the name Aku the Mystic, and he actually runs a psychic hotline thing through his room and, you know, throws tarot cards and does things, gives readings over the phone, and he believes in it so much that he actually wears a big purple, like, wizard robe that's festooned with stars and moons and stuff, and he's got a big Rasputin beard and long fingernails and stuff, and he has visions, you know, he definitely goes into trances and things, and he is one of Bert's kind of helpers throughout at times. And then he's got a couple of local friends. He's got a bartender at the local bar who he has a big crush on, and she and another regular at the bar have helped him out of some jams. And then, of course, there's his girlfriend who he meets and falls in love with in the first book. But the problem is, you know, it's very important for him that he has to stay out of trouble, of course. And this girl just happens to be the daughter of a man who's reputed to be a big, either current or former mobster. And so there's a very, like, there's a real shady kind of underworld vibe, and they're fabulously wealthy. And he lives in this little, you know, 120 square foot room or something or whatever it is in this rooming house. And she's got 5 acres overlooking the water, and they've got servants and all this, and she's crazy about him, and I think she knows that he needs some help and protection, and she's definitely there to help keep him in line.
Intriguing. So we have a lot of interesting things that he can get involved in with people that will help him along the way. And it's interesting that he's young, because for most of the cozy mysteries, I mean, people are not usually as young as that, so that makes you stand out a little bit. I've noticed there's a whole subgenre of senior sleuths that I didn't realize were out there. And so maybe you can have, like, the, you know, 20-something. I don't know if there are that many of those, not that I've seen. Have you seen others in the same age range?
I've heard some, but I was recently encouraged because I just started writing what I liked. I've always loved that age. And actually, when I started writing this, that first fragment I told you about many years ago, I was just a little... Yeah, I was just about that age, so...
Right.
I wanted to write, I didn't know it was called the cozy at the time, but I liked the traditional, that was what I liked. I didn't like hard-boiled or violence. I didn't like Jim Thompson style. I didn't like sadism or anything like that. So I just loved the traditional cozy-type mysteries, but I didn't see any with people like me in them. So I wrote this first character thinking, God, I'd just love to have some kind of clueless young guy be an amateur sleuth, like bumbling along and someone like me. So that was the original drive for me to write it. Now there are other demographics, shall we say, in that field. But that was my initial desire, was to just have someone like me be in one of these.
Well, I don't think you ever, I mean, I certainly didn't. You never really set out to Well, I shouldn't say you never do, but that's not the main motivation to set out this is going to be a bestseller, or this is, you know, because you never know if that's going to happen anyway. So you kind of have to write what you feel, and you have to. I always say the character kind of comes first. They usually pop up. In fact, I have another cast of characters waiting in the wings after I'm finished with this book that want to come up, and I keep telling them, you got to go back because I'm not ready for you yet.
Right.
You know, the characters are kind of there, ready to come out, and the loudest ones, you know, make their way out, and the story has to be told. And then the story kind of comes around, frames around the characters and that kind of thing. So I always think it's an intriguing process. But you do have to write what you want. But do you subscribe to the idea? I think Judy Blume was the one who said you get at a certain age is pivotal to a writer, and you're kind of stuck there. What is that age for you? You know, and that kind of thing. And I think for her, she was like 12 years old. And maybe for you, 23 is, you know. I mean, of course, I guess if you write enough of them, you're going to make him, you know, you'll have him age, I assume. Are you planning on writing a whole bunch of these Bird Shambles?
Yeah, I'm on the third one, and it'll be about 2 or 3 months into it. So I've got some time. I've got some time. But, yeah, that is my age, though. The 20s, I think.
I'm 20.
Because I think it's an age when if there's one point in my life I could go back and talk to my younger self, it would be then. And I think that's what I'm doing with my fiction. I think I'm trying to go back in time and counsel myself and soothe myself about certain decisions or certain feelings I had. You know, that was a very difficult time for me, and I can't go back and change it, but I can maybe change it for other people, and I can definitely share that. And I've also had a lot of humor comes out of that. And so I think for me, you know, a child, I love childhood too, but I feel they're not the masters of their own domain, and they're being told, and they're the very often, you know, the victims of forces around them more. But when you're finally out there on your own and just starting out, you know, I felt much older at 23 than I did at 43. You know, I felt very old, and kind of that life was really hard for some of those years, and then gradually.
Hello. Did I lose you? All right, I guess we lost you. You seem like you're... Tim, are you there? All right, he said some profound things. We'll see. Call back if you can. It is the Amy Beth Darkwood Show. You can reach out, too, via Twitter, AB Wright, phone line 347-857-4505. We'll see if we can hook up again. Leaving us hanging, a cliffhanger from a mystery author. Who knew? It is the Amy Beth Darkwood Show. If you can, we're gonna disconnect that line because apparently it's not working. Meantime, we'll get you in the mix. Again, the Twitter feed is AB Wright. The phone line 347-857-4505.
Here.
Hi.
Hello.
We got disconnected. I don't know what happened. It's the gremlins in our system. What can you do?
It is.
Okay. It looked like you were still there, but all of a sudden you were gone. All right.
Well, I could hear you, and I could hear myself in the phone. The connection was live on my end, but I guess you couldn't hear me.
Oh, that's so funny. So weird. Okay. No, I couldn't hear you. So tell me, what were we talking about? Do you remember?
Yeah, we were just saying about that age group.
How hard it seemed when you were young. Yeah, right. In the age.
Yeah, and I just feel like that's an area where you're finally on your own, you're getting out there in the world, and there's a lot of things I would probably tell myself, you know, not be so serious, not be so hard on myself, give myself a little more space, remember to enjoy myself, and, you know, so I think that age, it's definitely, for me, it's that early to mid-20s is definitely the age that I kind of am in for my writing.
So what do you think is going to happen if you stick with the Bird Shambles mysteries and he gets older? Is that going to be harder for you, or are you just going to leave him at a certain point and move on to somebody else who's in their 20s?
Well, I'm pretty much, I'm almost going in real time. I mean, I figure at this point I've got 12 books per year of his life I could potentially write about.
Oh, I see. You're writing. Yeah. He's stumbling upon bodies every couple of months, not every couple of years.
Oh, yeah. No. I'm on book three now, and it's only about 3 months after the first book.
Oh, okay. Oh, so you're really going to have him. Yeah.
It actually picks up exactly the end of the second book ends with a knock on the door and a character appearing, and then the third book picks right up with that conversation. Like, it doesn't. So there's really, time-wise, there's no break between the second and third books.
So this small town that you made up in Long Island is going to rival Cabot Cove, Maine, for the highest murder rate per capita, I guess.
I hope so. Absolutely. I know. It's.
Well, you know, in Murder, She Wrote, they had to move her, because it was on for so long, they had to move her around a lot. Like, she had to take trips and go have a teaching job in New York and go visit friends in France. And, of course, mysteriously, there was a murder everywhere she went. So you might have to have her go on a trip or something. You know?
Yes, well, I always thought she was doing it, of course.
That's what I said. I said they should have ended with her being a serial killer, because every time she showed up, there was a murder. And when she left time, the town could, you know, sigh of relief. Oh, she's gone, so it's not going to happen this time. But... you know, there is, of course, a suspension of disbelief on these in this genre, because you have to accept the fact there's going to be a murder, and you have to accept the fact. I was on I saw a chat room of readers once, and they were talking about things they liked and didn't like about Cozy Mysteries, and one of the comments that somebody made was, "I'm sick and tired of seeing the side romances and all this kind of stuff, and also it's a small town, and I was reading a book with a single protagonist, and all of a sudden she's got a whole bunch of men after her. I mean, that's not realistic." I was like, "Yeah, but it's not realistic that you'd have a murder every week either."
Right.
So you have to kind of, you know.
I know. You know, I watch. I'm a big fan of. I read the books originally. That Midsummer Murders is based on. They're one of the PBS, you know, British mysteries, and I always think about that too, because it's like. Especially when it's a police officer and, like, these two constables are figuring all this stuff out, like a lot of the British mysteries, you think, how does this guy still have a job? Like 5,000 people have been murdered around him, and he's and it's the most unsafe place in the world. It's like it's a massacre. How are there any citizens left in this town? And why does this clown still have a job? He's got to do an ounce of prevention here, you know, but I still watch it religiously and faithfully, you know.
Well, because we're on the gag, sort of. I mean, that's the thing that I like about it, I guess, is it's a puzzle wrapped into a story, because part of it is the puzzle and solving it, and part of the job of the writer is to do what I call literary sleight of hand. You know, while these people are trying to figure out the main mystery, you have another little side mystery over here, and you have a romance over there, and, you know, you're trying diversionary tactics to say to them, you know, look over here, you know, follow this shiny object while, you know, we're planting clues that you may avoid or you may miss, that kind of thing. So, it's interesting. How do you do it? I mean, do you have it all plotted out, or do you, you know, go as you write it as you go?
Well, I've started writing a second series now, so especially to keep things organized in my own head, I've started doing some outlining and a little bit. Not fastidious and obsessive, but I definitely want to write through a pretty well what I think is going to happen, because what I have found in the last books is I'd end up with a 65,000-page manuscript, and I'd have a cut-and-pasted errata file of stuff I ended up not using that would be 100, 125,000 words. So I just found that I was not being efficient enough with my story. I was doing too much exploration and rewriting, and I let characters plot to me. So the characters definitely lead, and I take dictation behind them when I'm lucky, when I'm not trying to control the outcome.
Yeah.
So I definitely find that the characters, you know, I'll be in bed with my wife and go, oh my gosh, you know what I found out? You know what happened to Bert? You know, da da da. And I talk about them very much like real people. I gossip about them, what I heard, what I found out about them. I couldn't believe it. I didn't know this. I just found out, blah, blah, blah. Because it really feels that way to me when it's going well. But I need to get some product done, you know? You said, like, I have that need. I need to keep getting to the words, the end. Those are the words I'm trying to write.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I have a new thing, a new series, and I did write out a lot of, you know, I tried to get it into one sentence, one paragraph, like an elevator pitch. I tried to do a one-pager, and then I ended up with about between 10 and 20 pages where, now the story, I haven't gone back and updated it. At a certain point, I just get into writing the story, but that book is only about two chapters away from being done, this new first in this new series, and I'd say that rather than my usual 100,000 words of cut and paste, you know, unused stuff, I have about 20,000 words. So okay. I've done that in 5 months with a, you know, full-time job and other stuff going on. So for me, the process of investing a few weeks or a few months, just getting any of my thoughts out in a sort of rough synopsis kind of format has helped enormously. So I'm just going to keep going with that for now. This is the first time I've tried using that.
Can you give me a preview of that new series, or you don't want to do that yet?
Oh, sure. Well, the new series, it's a little bit more high concept, you know, whereas Bert is a young male out in Long Island. I also lived for about 4 or 5 years in a beautiful, picturesque town out in Illinois, and I based a series out there in, like, a very sort of pretty country town in Illinois with a young woman protagonist, and she's about 25. And the setup with that, though, is, you know, I like pushing boundaries a little. I thought, well, if I have a young male protagonist in a genre that's mostly older women protagonists, what else can I do to kind of, like, have fun with the convention? So they tell you one of the things you should never write about is politics. So what I decided to do, my new protagonist is a very earnest, progressive, NPR, yoga, you know, save the world. As I describe her, you know, my character had always wanted to save the world, and she had all the canvas tote bags to prove it. You know, she's a joiner, she's a believer, she has causes, she's a very idealistic and serious young woman. And this guy moves in next door who is a flaming Rush Limbaugh, loudly, you know, ditto head, right-wing conservative, and the two of them, you know, find a dead body straddling their property line. And now they've got to get into it together. So for me, a soapbox is I only build soapboxes. The higher the soapbox, the farther my character can slip off it and fall. So I definitely am not trying to preach politics, but I'm making fun of the argument that's going on.
Yeah, well, you got both sides. So both sides will be either like it or hate it or whatever. So you'll see how
it is an embarrassment of riches for a writer. I'll tell you, I cannot.
For sure. So before we let you go, and I know you got to go and we got to get moving here, but just give us a little insight for those people who are reading, who are aspiring writers, who are always curious about the process. And we talked a little bit about the outlining, but what about your time schedule? I mean, you mentioned you're balancing a real 9-to-5 type job. What do you do in terms of your schedule? Do you have a set schedule that you write X number of hours, pages? How does that work for you? Or are you more flexible? Tell me a little bit about that.
I've simplified it to one thing, just never a day without a line, as the man once said, Zola or whoever. You just have to show up at the page every day. I don't always have control. I could sit there for 6 hours and squeak out a paragraph and feel like I want to slip my wrists when I'm done. I can have 45 minutes waiting in an airport terminal between flights and write 1,000 words that are the best thing I've ever written. I have no idea when or how I will be able, what the end result will be. My job is just to show up, put up my little antenna, and try to tune in the station the best that I can. And that's all I do. That is my rule, that I show up every day.
Show up at the page, and you never know what will happen. The muse sometimes is with you, and sometimes she ain't, but she'll come back again. You just got
to
keep
going. But you show up, and your part is to sit your butt in the chair and to show up for yourself and for the story.
That's
the
kind of
a paraphrase
of Dorothy Parker. Yeah, sounds good.
Oh, is that what
Jen
really?
Hall, pleasure. Yeah, she said the trick to writing is to sit your, I think, arse in the seat, I think she said. Or arse in the chair, yeah.
Nice.
All right, Tim Hall, the books are Dead Stock and Tie Dye, the Bert Shambles Mysteries, a new series coming out shortly. You can find out more at your website. It's timhallbooks.wordpress.com. As always, I will post the link. And I thank you so much for joining us, and I hope you come back and see us again when you got something new cooking. Okay, Bert? I was calling you Bert. Tim, sorry.
That works for me. Thanks so much, Amy. It's been a pleasure.
Take care. That's Tim Hall. Get you into the mix at 347-857-4505. The Twitter feed, AB Writes. Yeah, Trudy, we're doing it.
Isn't that beautiful? I love of a murder mystery upon the radio. I love it, I love it, I really love it so. The heroine is yelling while the sponsor goes on selling.
Don't touch me, you brute!
Use delirium for your tube.
Sam shovels in a hovel, he must grovel for a clue. I love it, I love it, I rally, rally do.
Sherlock Holmes, the giver's own, so interrupted by the sponsor.
You see Watson, when the villain.
Painless Joe, do you drillin'? I'm nervous when I turn the dial, I'm dizzy in the head. When it's time for Inner Sanctum, I go underneath my bed.
Don't shoot me, Biggs, the stoolie, as they put him through the mill.
I'll shoot you, I'll shoot you. Seriously, I will. The girl he tried to take, and then we have a station break.
Come on, baby, come to me. Boing, boing, boing. This is Station C-O-D.
He's not breathing. But how can he? He's dead. He's dead! Why, this is a job for Superman, or Hopalong Cavity, or Jack Headstrong, the All-American Boy, or Jerry Lewis. But I don't scare easily, not me. I'm too frightened to be scared. I'll find the killer. I'll search the apartment. Aha! Just as I thought. Three shoes under the bed. Well, that's logical for a man with 3 feet.
But I have it now, Inspector. I can name the killer for you. His name is...
Painless Joe will do you drillin'. My flesh begins to creep and then my skin begins to crawl. You think I was a worm the way I wiggled down the hall. I love a murder mystery upon the radio. I love it, I love it, I really love it so. I love it when I'm listening late at night and a murderer is stalking a heroine. And a hero is stalking a murderer and a private eye is stalking a hero. And a cop is stalking a private eye. And they're coming in closer and closer. Surely, but closer and surely. They're coming out of the radio. Now they're stalking me. What have I done? I was only listening to the radio. Now they're throwing toothpaste at me. They're coming closer and closer. And I don't know the conjunctive moves of anyone that may be based on the fact that other people say the same their facts. Where else but the Splendor? And certainly not the one in the field. I'm not going on the moment. Anyone else may say I'm wrong. And I feel that I must stay here now. No one else will ever know the facts. I wish I was dead.
My monster and black type. You've got the kind of blood that I like. I remember the day you dragged me away and left me on a barbed wire fence. My monster and black type. You've got the kind of eye that I like. With your wrinkled up chin where the worms have been, you make me wanna hold you tight. Oh, I love to see you hopping along. What else can he do with three legs? No, it made him ever so wrong. I like you best when you're in your best. My monster in black tights. You're everything a freak like I like. And if you say you won't run away, I'll untie your chains today. Oh, I love to see you hopping along. I've got three legs too. No, it may seem ever so wrong. I like you best when you're in your best. My monster is black tight. You're everything a freak like I like. And if you say you won't run away, I'll untie your chains today. And I'll feed you, dear. And I'll take your cage away. Come on, my dear, my hideous little monster. Let's go for what is in the graveyard. Come on.
Come in. Who is it? No! Ah!
He's a vampire.
Trudy Hart, every time we have a mystery author on, we have to play the Jerry Lewis classic, I Love a Murder Mystery, upon the radio. And we had one such creature with us today, Tim Hall. Find out more about his Bert Shambles Mysteries at timhallbooks.wordpress.com. Fascinating tales from behind the scenes, some great insights, and just working hard, and that perseverance thing, what I always say, you got to keep doing it. Fall in love with the process, and trust it. You got to trust the process, right? You show up at the page, that's what I always say. And you let the muse do her thing or his thing. You know, maybe your muse is a guy. I don't know. Sometimes he's a guy. Sometimes he's a girl. But he will show up. Maybe not exactly when you want him or her to do it, but when you're ready. And when the characters are ready to talk, I always say that's the key. You know, they're waiting in the wings. Sometimes they do interesting things, and sometimes they just don't. You got to be patient, but you'll develop that over time. But show up and try something every single day. And the Inspiration to Action Challenge has helped a lot of people sort of gear up and get back into it because it's sort of a meditation of embracing your creative spirit and the resource that is within you. We have you journaling every single day, those things that bring you joy, inspiration, those things which you are grateful. And remember, you want to weave in the acts of kindness you've bestowed upon other people or people have bestowed upon you. Just see how that changes the way you walk in the world and the way you look at things. It's worked for a lot of people. I'm always gratified when it does. In fact, a good segue today, let's cheer on Charlie, who is our Inspiration to Action Challenge shout-out today from Delaware. He is working on painting and a novel. He said, I was dormant for a long time in terms of creativity, but I said, what the heck, I'll try it. And it's working for me in ways I can't begin to explain, but I thank you so much. I'm not sure how it works, but it does. So people should try it. I encourage that. Well, thank you, Charlie, for the kind words. I appreciate that. And I think it does help. Have some faith. Try it. Can't promise things. Not a panacea, but I think it might help you get on the track. If it's working for you, reach out via the website, amybetharkawy.com. That's A-R-K-A-W-Y, easy access via the Twitter feed. You need some cajoling? We can start a creativity coaching conversation. First one, always on me. So I love the Halloween music, but there are also some other great seasonal tunes that I love this time of year. Here's one from Dan Fogelberg, Old Tennessee.
October, the sleepy brown woods seem to nod down their heads to the winter. Yellows and grays paint the sad skies today, and I wonder when you're coming home.
and I've got no heat here, and I miss your fire so sweet. Dear, I miss your fire so sweet. And I hear you're in San Francisco, living with your sister who's a mother to me, and her husband's way down in Georgia.
Yeah.
brilliant disguise for Halloween. Bruce Springsteen on the Amy Beth Arkley Show, and Dan Fogelberg spending end of October in Old Tennessee. Welcome aboard the Amy Beth Arkley Show. Reach out via Twitter, AB Writes, phone line 347-857-4505. It's pretty much a pair of rusty tin cans over there anyway, because no one ever calls us anymore. It's all about Twitter, right? It's all about the Twitter feed, which is pretty busy. Philly says, hey, a great interview. You got a great rapport with your guest. Well, thank you, Philly. Dondi says the book sounds good, and you have a way with the interview, AB. Well, thank you. Nixie chiming in, good show. Really enjoy the tunes. Are you going to play more vintage Halloween songs? Yeah, we are. We got a few more coming today, and our crypt is crammed with all kinds of seasonal goodies for Friday's annual Halloween Spooktacular. So get ready, live Friday, October 30th. At noon Eastern Time, and thereafter on podcast. Speaking of which, don't forget, you can follow us any way you want to find us. You can find us. Follow us at the Blog Talk Radio site, also available on Stitcher. They have an app, so it's portable. Take us wherever you want to. People are listening on smartphones. I don't get some of the new technology, but I appreciate it. Go for it. Also part of the Mixcloud family, and so thrilled to be part of Arts Radio Network and PopNet, as well as iTunes. So again, find us. We want to be found. Enjoy the show, and we're happy you're part of it. So I'm going to, do we want to do that first? No, let's talk the pop culture convo briefly. We don't have that much time, but we'll do a little bit of it. It looks like Donald Trump is down. Yeah, there's a new contender atop the GOP leaderboard. Ben Carson. Yeah, the soft-spoken, crazy-talking, retired neurosurgeon is besting Donald Trump in Iowa and also in a new national poll just released from CNN today. And Trump is not happy about it, as you can imagine. He's discounting the polls. Ouch, but the new debate, there's another debate happening tomorrow on CNBC. They wrinkled the time, you know, 2 hours to make sure that Donald Trump would have tweeting time and Ben Carson could go to sleep. And, of course, after Hillary Clinton's performance before the Benghazi committee with 11 hours of testimony, I guess really 9 because they took a break for lunch and dinner, you know, who's got the stamina now, if you know what I'm saying? But we'll see what happens tomorrow. Jeb Bush, also kind of in the news, he's kind of throwing a couple of tantrums. He's cutting back on his staff and his finances, even though he's got more money in terms of PAC money thrown into his campaign, but he's cutting back because things are not looking so great right now. He's dipping in the polls, in fact. Although I think he inched up 2 points in the New Hampshire poll from 6% to 8%. Not doing all that well, Jeb. But he kind of had a tantrum the other day saying that if people, he's not interested in gridlock and he's not interested in a campaign, if people just want a lot of screaming, let them vote for Donald Trump, he said, because I have cooler things I could be doing. Really? Cooler things, Jeb? You're in your 60s, right? You're running for president. If running for president isn't a cool thing, maybe you shouldn't be doing it. Just putting that out there. Sounds like he's running home to mommy and daddy with his marbles. They're going to, you know, kind of huddle together to kind of reassess this whole campaign thing. But we'll see what happens tomorrow at the debate. Meanwhile, Donald Trump, in a town hall on NBC yesterday, said that he started out modestly with a small $1 million loan from his father. Now, how many people would like a small $1 million loan from their fathers, right? Out of touch much? Like Mitt Romney? You remember Mitt Romney when Ann Romney said, oh, they had to cut out some of their investment coupons to afford their living expenses while they were in grad school? Ouch-a-doodle-doo. Let's take a peek at the, we got a phone call. That's amazing. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. Thank you. What makes you think that anybody's going to be bothering with the Republican debate when we have to watch the Mets?
Yes. I was just going to say that. I'm not going to be bothering. I personally will be watching the Mets. Tonight they start in Kansas City. Tomorrow is another game in KC. And, you know, we'll see the highlights, though, because we'll replay it over and over again on the debate stage.
Well, I hope you're up for a late night because it's going to be raining there, and we may have delays. It's going to be raining in Kansas
tonight?
City tonight. Yes, and they said that they will not reschedule, so we could be there till 1 or 2 in the morning.
Oh, dear. Okay, well, if they have delays, we can always watch The Voice and The Muppets. So.
Well, that's true, too. But
there's always a silver lining, but I guess you're rooting for the Mets, I gather.
I don't know how you figured that one out. Very clever.
Well, because you said you're gonna root for the Mets at your opening.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah, so do you have any predictions? Do you think how many games do you think we're gonna go before we clinch it?
Oh, I don't know, but we're not gonna take the whole thing at once, so it'll be a very interesting series, but I think we're gonna take it.
I hope we win at home.
I do too. It would be very
nice. Hopefully, we'll win within five because we're coming home for the you know, second round.
This
all right,
will be good.
Anything else you want to tell us?
No, that's all. Thanks a lot for the Halloween Spectacular and your guests. Very interesting.
Well, thanks so much for enjoying.
And
thanks
for
the calling
good work.
In. I appreciate it. There's so few people bother to call in anymore.
Well, I think they're busy, but they do listen. I know a lot of people listen to your show because it's a great one.
They do. Thank you. Well, they chime in on Twitter, that's for sure. Okay, thanks
Absolutely.
For calling. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Have a good one. Bye-bye.
You too. Take care. Okay, and let's go Mets. We'll see what happens tonight. It is the Amy the Dark Way Show. Reach out via Twitter, AB Wright, phone line 347-857-4505. So this always interests me because Halloween costumes can, you know, stir your imagination, but they can also stir up some controversy. People get themselves into trouble by wearing crazy kind of costumes. And one couple in Alabama are under the gun. Teacher, by the way, who posed with his wife in a controversial blackface Halloween photo. You see what I'm saying? See where this is going? Apologized for his quote-unquote error in judgment, but they both maintain they didn't intend any malice. Heath Morrow and his wife, Shannon, were under fire after posting a photo on Facebook of the couple dressed as Kanye West and Kim Kardashian. In the photo, Heath Morrow can be seen in blackface. Ouch, never a good idea. Have we not learned anything from Paula Deen? While wearing Kanye's signature glasses and holding the sign that read, Kanye for Prez 2020. The couple posted the photo on Facebook, but it took it down following an uproar. And the quote is, the wife says, I didn't know dressing up as a celebrity couple would cause so much controversy. This is what she told the Daily News on Monday. There was no malicious intent in this costume. It's for Halloween. Just the one time a year, it is okay. Well, yeah, And by the way, she added, oh, you're going to love this one, some of my husband's best friends are black. There was no racial intent whatsoever. Insensitivity, perhaps. I'm not saying she intended to be malicious or that she's racist, but people have to be a little more in tune with what's acceptable in our times. I mean, I don't get it. But there you go. And, of course, when you put anything out on Facebook, you're going to get some reaction that might not be the one you want. Just saying. Speaking of which, what's your favorite costume? Are you going dressed up this year, or do you remember a costume that you wore? I had a frog costume I wore a couple of years, and I don't know why. I had a very heavy, hot mask, and I don't even know why I wanted to be a frog. I guess I liked the color green as a kid or something, but usually it was a witch. I'm still in my witchly mode for obvious reasons. All right, back to reach out, tell us your favorite Halloween costume now or then. AB Wright on the Twitter feed, 347-857-4505 on the phone lines. So back to our Halloween collection. We've got lots of them, lots of extras that we discovered that we didn't get into the crypt, so we're playing them today. But here's a trivia question for you. You can answer via Twitter if you're listening live, or any if you're not listening live, but I just you won't know that you got it right. I just found this out. Name the famous composing team that wrote the theme to The Blob. Remember The Blob? Think about it. I'm going to play the song. Maybe you'll get a sense of famous, very famous. They had a bunch of hits in the 60s and early 70s. Famous composing duo, won bunches of awards, and they also wrote the theme to The Blob. Reach out via Twitter, AB Wright, phone line 347-857-4505. Here it is.
Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob. Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob.
Oh.
Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob. Beware of the blob, it creeps and leaps and glides and slides across the floor, right through the door and all around the wall. A splotch, a blotch, be careful of the blob. Beware of the blob, it creeps.
People in the streets see it now. They're running toward the East River, thousands of them, dropping in like rats. Now the smoke's spreading faster. It's reached Times Square. People are trying to run away from it, but it's no use. They're falling like flies.
small beginner. With her there, I'm a winner. She pulls your heartstrings until they snap. Breaks your heart, but you know you crawl right back.
Show the magics and the zombie walk and the five blobs with the theme from The Blob. Trivia question: what famous award-winning composing duo wrote the theme from The Blob? The Twitter feed at AB Writes, a couple of folks chiming in, all wrong so far. Daisy, Shay, and Timmy all say Lennon and McCartney. Now, good guess. They had a bunch of hits in the 60s, but not right. And Carl, we know you're messing with us when you say the Gershwins. Famous, they just won the Gershwin Prize, though, for popular song a couple of years ago. Famous, popular composing duo had a string of hits in the 60s, early 70s. They wrote the theme from The Blob. Think about it. Let us know via Twitter, AB Writes, and we'll rustle up a prize or two. ML has the keys to the prize closet, so it'll probably be something related to coffee or the Mets. And remember, knowledge is its own reward. Hey, the TCS crew also came up with this one. It's an intriguing parody for the season from the Neon Trees tune. This one is Everybody Haunts. I'm Amy Beth Arkley Show.
My baby bought a house tonight. It's a low price she didn't question. But baby got such a fright when the ghost started their possession. We're just too good looking to in love to die today. We found out that everybody haunts, everybody haunts, everybody haunts.
It started with a demon, souls of an ancient Indian. He tried to do us all in. We could hear the screaming. Let's split up and be saved. Mama's always got a with a neck bite, had a sex appeal from Twilight. Yeah, maybe this is so tried, but I could kill the black guy. You're a virgin, so you won't die, unless that was a big lie. Everybody haunts, babe. Never thought I'd live to see the day. It started with Wes Craven, or maybe Post the Raven. Now there's no safe haven, a blue lagoon creature. It's like a double feature. Mama's always afraid to eat her.
Coming to our Halloween convention of spooks.
You remember in the 60s when I invented the marsh? Well, now the time has come for me to update that smash. Since I've been out of the fright game for 52 odd years, I invited a new crew to spread spooky cheer. The first to arrive was Dr. Hannibal Lecter. He brought his own date, and he seemed to respect her. They hit the dance floor with a jive and a jitter. Then he ripped off her face! He's pulling out her liver!
That's really gross.
Oh my God, what just happened?
He ate her face.
Yes, I know! I saw!
Speaking of small,
I like to play disgusting games.
He broke his jaw.
That is way too graphic. I'm going to faint. Surely all the other guests won't be this rude. Like this classic monster, a scary hip dude. He's got a kooky style and a spooktastic look. Oh my God, he just hung the waiter on a meat hook. Why? He's cutting him up with a chainsaw.
It's what he does.
Who is Freddy Krueger?
He haunts your dreams.
Ooh, he sounds like a real spooker.
I murder teens. You can't escape me, bitch.
Language. In my day, the monsters would just give you a spook. Nowadays, it seems they all just want to make you puke. Ah, the human centipede. That sounds like a hit. Wait, the ones in back have to eat the front one's shit? Enough! The party's over. Everybody out. You all have no idea what Spooktober is about. Here comes the Wolfman. He'll show you how it's done. He knows how to be creepy, but he always keeps it fun. No! That was my friend! Why did he meet such a horrifying end? Is it too much to ask to have some monsters dance? It's really quite a hoot if you give it half a chance.
This guy won't let it go. I think it's rather sad.
Guys, I feel guilty.
And I also feel bad.
Let's give him a couple moves. It's the least we can do.
Okay, places, everybody. And a one, and a two.
Look at us dance.
You did the monster dance?
Hey, look, jazz hands.
Don't twist too fast.
Her shoulders smash. Oh, great. It's the girl from the ring.
Her heart is black.
Ooh, she really knows how to swing.
I wouldn't look directly at her face if I were you.
Ooh. Oh, well, we tried.
He died doing what he loved. Monster choreography. Hey, guys, I know a game we could play. Guys, anyone?
Thanks for watching.
This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen. Out of character, to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be. The Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo.
I was a teenage monster.
I was.
Bye.
Bye.
Till I'm in a dream.
Teenage Monster. The Ketones, a group from the 80s that kind of sounded like the early 60s on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show, or Halloween Spooktacular preview, and a pair from the Spoof Collection, Modern Monster Mash from the folks at Key of Awesome, and the TCS crew found Everybody Haunts. More of these? You love them? I know you do. The Songs of Halloween, seasonal and fun. Our crypt is crammed. Join us this Friday for the annual Halloween Spooktacular, 12 noon, Eastern Time, and thereafter on podcast. I think you'll enjoy it all weekend long. It's always a fun adventure. So speaking of adventures, the Mets are in Kansas City. Our caller said it could be a late night. Rain expected today, so you might want to take a power nap or two. I say let's go, Mets. If you're rooting for KC, good for you. We're headed there, and this is our Forgotten 45 from Wilbert Harrison. Kansas City, our Forgotten 45 from Wilbert Harrison, as we head to the World Series, the Mets and the KC Royals. Hey, if you've got a Forgotten 45, one of those moldy oldies you'd like us to play, by all means, send it to us via the Twitter feed at ABWrites, hashtag Forgotten45, or a missive over at the website, amybetharkowee.com. Thanks going out again to Tim Hall. Find out more about his Bert Shambles mysteries and other exciting doings at his website, timhallbooks.wordpress.com. I will post the link for you along with the podcast when it's ready. And that's about it, I guess. Hey, thanks to the TCS crew, Trudy and Aurora in the booth, ML at headquarters. Thank you for playing with us. Oh, the trivia question, you didn't get it right. Who wrote the theme for The Blob? Guess what? It's Burt Bacharach and Hal David. Yeah, no kidding. I guess Hal David had to write those lyrics. A lot of fascinating fun indeed. All right, so whatever you do, wherever you go, whoever you're rooting for, drive safe, play nice, dream big. Please come back and see us on the Amy Beth Arkowitz Show. And just in case for Mets fans, a little help from CCR, I put a spell on you. We'll talk next time. Take care.
Oh, change to protect the innocent.
Big old pumpkin style. Pumpkin style. Walking down the street with a big bag, light is empty. One treat is not enough, that's persistence. Give me 20. Buy me all anything, just want a bag full of candies. Mars, Reese's, Kit Kat, Whoppers, Hershey's. They say I'm lazy. Compete against me and I'll steal this candy from a baby. Forget knocking door to door and asking you to treat me. I'd much rather trick than treat, so you be ready now. Listen up, baby. Give me candy, a sugar orgy, cavity, hey, who cares, it's free, hey. Give me candy, my sugar fantasy, vegetables, no, you already know, oh, chocolate, bubblegum, jelly beans, and lollipop. Big old pumpkin style. Pumpkin style. Big, 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 big. Big old pumpkin style. Pumpkin style. Big, 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 big. Big old pumpkin style. Hey, give me candy. Big, 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 big. Big old pumpkin style. Hey, give me candy. Big, 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 big. Parents come to me and say I stole their baby's candy, leaving them with rice they got from those weird Asian families. But I don't listen, cause that's just lame insanity. Oh please, step aside, ladies. I'm the pumpkin king. Zombies are hungry, so I feed them with a chicken wing. Witches can't make me disappear, cause I'm the pumpkin king. Vampires want to fight me, but I counter with a baseball swing. I'm the pumpkin king. Give me candy, a sugar orgy, cavity, hey, who cares, it's free, hey. Give me candy, my sugar fantasy, vegetables, no, you already know, oh, chocolate, bubblegum, jelly beans, and lollipop. Big old pumpkin style.